Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is a first-time author at age 75. Garth Nielsen was born in Glendale, California, grew up in Nevada, and has loved the high deserts all his life. He and his wife Barbara now live in Paradise, California. Throughout his life, he's been able to participate in traditional Native American ceremonies and to talk to traditional elders. As a way of thanking all those who have reached out in friendship over the years, Garth Nielsen has written a collection of essays, which he calls The Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad. Garth Nielsen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, most people have a dedication in their book, and on your dedication page, you start by thanking your spouse. And a lot of times people do that. That's fairly typical. And in particular, you say you want to dedicate this to her, your wife, Barb, for her loving and constant support.
I wouldn't have been able to do this without her.
She also was editor for your book,
yes, ma'am.
Wasn't she? And then you also say this book is dedicated to all the Native peoples who have been an essential and constant part of my life over the years in many different places. People who have shared their life ways, their concerns, their hopes and dreams, their diligence in being true to their peoples, and in some cases, their sacred ceremonies.
That's right.
What a privilege.
I feel so privileged that there's no words to express the gratitude that I have in my heart for my dear, dear friends who have been an integral part of my life, all my life.
And this comes through in the pages of your book.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to read your appreciation and respect for what you learned from them. Now, you also say you dedicate the book to the Maya people of Chiapas, Mexico. You honored them. You talk about them in your book as well. So now, after the dedication page, there's an introduction by somebody named Joseph Garcia, and he describes you as an artist and a writer.
I'm also a painter.
Yeah, and you have sketches in your book that you did.
Yeah.
And at what point in your life did you become an artist?
From the time I was old enough to pick up a crayon. My father was an artist, and he was my first teacher.
Mr. Garcia also says that you have spent many years attempting to learn and understand how to walk on the red road.
Yes, ma'am.
He doesn't say what the red road is, and in fact, you don't, in your book later, you talk about the red road, but you don't really tell us. So what is the red road?
The red road is primarily the way Native people interact with the earth, with themselves, and with their creator, or God, if you will, and how we maintain that cohesiveness with those three elements, with themselves, with their associates, with the earth and with the creator.
And why the color red?
Because Native people are considered the Red Nation.
So this book is about your experience walking the red road.
Yes, ma'am.
Because, and especially here in the North State, there are a lot of people who choose to walk a path over in Europe that has been popular since the Middle Ages, the Camino across Spain to Santiago. And I'm one of those people, so I understand this. In fact, I wear a shell in commemoration, and it's a symbol of the pilgrim. I really feel we're all pilgrims of some nature or other.
Hence the name of my book.
Yes, The Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad, The Odyssey. Another way of saying it's all this path that we're walking through life.
That's right. It's my distinct observations that so many people that I have known over the years don't know who they are. They don't know their antecedents. They don't know where they came from. They know nothing about themselves. And with that in mind, I mean, I do know where my antecedents came from, but in any event, it's been my feeling from the time I was very young that I feel that we, as Euro-Americans, are usurpers on this, what they call the Great Turtle Island, or North America. We need to pay attention to what the indigenous peoples who have lived here for thousands upon thousands of years, what they have learned, and how they have come to appreciate what the circumstances of their lives are, a gift from the Creator and from the earth.
In fact, you write this in your book. It's actually the last chapter in your book. You say, we don't often know who we are, what we are, or where we came from. From those of us who can never go home again, it's essential that we begin the process of listening to the spirit of the land we now walk on.
That's right.
The land called, as you mentioned, Turtle Island, which is what Native Americans call the
North America.
North America. In fact, you each chapter you have a sketch of a turtle
because
to start the chapter.
That's my clan. I was adopted into the Mohawk Nation, and I'm a member of the Turtle Clan of the Mohawk Nation.
You continue, I think it is essential that we begin to listen to these indigenous peoples who have been here for thousands of years. What do they have to say? What can they teach each of us?
That's right.
And you mentioned that you are adopted into, you have an adoptive mother and father. Who are they?
They have both passed on to the spirit world.
And one was, your father was?
I was adopted as an adult, not as a child.
Right.
And my adopted father was a Seneca man, which is one of the six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, known as the Haudenosaunee, which means the people of the longhouse. And he was probably one of the kindest, most loving, respectful people I've ever known in my life. He was a very lonely old man. And his wife, who was a white woman, had died many years prior to my meeting him. And he lived on property that was owned by his sister-in-law and her husband. They made a small cabin for him, and he could no longer get about by himself because of his poor eyesight and failing health. But when I met him, it was like meeting an old friend that I hadn't seen in many, many, many years. It was an instantaneous reciprocity, a feeling of love between the two of us. And over the years, he and my wife and I became very, very close. And he shared his life story with me. He told me that he had, because of his light skin, he had tried to pass himself off as white, and he was very sorry for what he had done.
Well, because in those days, when he was growing up, you weren't supposed to speak your language.
That's right.
You weren't supposed to, you were supposed to blend in with the white population.
Exactly. And it was through those conversations that it finally came to a point where he told me, I am adopting you as my son. You're more of a blood relative to me than, more of a relative to me than my blood relations. I was overwhelmed. I mean, I was merely trying to be a friend to a kind, loving old man. And he repaid me so abundantly. It was one of the most amazing things that has ever taken place in my life. I was so humbled by his love and kindness.
So your adoptive father is Seneca and your mother Mohawk.
Yes, ma'am. She, again, the thing that struck me more than I can even express in words was the kindness and the love and the respect that these people showed. They have set aside the animosity. They've set aside the hurt. They set aside the pain that has been inflicted upon them. And they reach out their hands with love, with respect, and with kindness. And again, my Mohawk mother, she told me she was 30 years old when her mother told her she was an indigenous woman. And she said, I asked my mother, why didn't you tell me? She said, because those white people will eat you alive if they know that you're an Indian. And so she said, I've had to play catch up all my life. And in that, I initially at one time in my life had planned on going for a degree in anthropology, specializing in Native American cultures. I knew a fair amount about the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois people. And she told me, you have helped me so much in helping me to understand what it means to be an indigenous person. And it was through those conversations, she said, But one day she called me on the phone. She said, I want you to come out to the reservation next weekend if you can. And so we did. And she said, I want you to know, I went up to Akwesasne, which is also known as the St. Regis Reservation. It's up on the St. Lawrence River. It's a Mohawk reservation. And she said, I've spoken to the Council of Chiefs about you. And they said, if this man's heart is good, as you say it is, he will understand our words. We are going to refuse the request at this time because there have been many honorable Anglo people who have been adopted into.
But your mother didn't take no for an answer.
Not one single bit. She said, what takes place in my living room does not have to be known by the Council of Chiefs. She said, my husband and your wife are witness to my words this day.
My guest is Garth Nielsen. His book is a collection of essays he calls The Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad. And you, early in your book, say that Europeans on this continent are not yet able to understand this hemisphere. They have not lived here for uncounted generations. Most of them have no concept of what it is to be related to this earth and all that is upon it. They have no knowledge of how to live in balance and harmony on Turtle Island, the Native American name for North America. So I feel that this book is an attempt to help, I don't know if I want to use the word correct, this misunderstanding. Because you say early in your preface, you say that you're writing this book because you feel that you have something to say for a younger generation. And I get the sense that you feel it is an obligation as an older person, as an elder yourself.
Yes, ma'am.
To pass along what you have learned.
Yes, ma'am. I completely believe that. I mentioned in there about a television program I saw many years ago about the Haida people who live on Queen Charlotte Island off the coast of British Columbia. And the narrator, a Haida woman, said, if a person has lived their life and they come to a point where they can be considered to be an elder, if they have no story to tell, then their life has been lived as a waste or not fulfilled. Because of where I have been and the people that I have known and the experiences that I feel have been given to me, I do have something to say, which I want to pass on to preferably a younger generation of Native people.
Well, you, in your preface, is the first time we encounter this expression in, and I'm not sure what language, because you don't say, but it translates in English to all my relations.
Metakoyasin. That's from the Lakota people. Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people. What that, I've got very close associations with the Lakota people.
Well, the first time we encounter that expression early in your book, and we don't really understand this expression, and even when the translation, all my relations, I'm not sure listeners understand. Garth, what do you mean by all my relations?
Well, if a person were to take a serious look at their environment, a lot of people will maybe snicker or smile at this, but the trees, the shrubs, the bushes are our relations because it's the green and growing nations, to use a phrase that Native people use. The green and growing nations are our relatives who are giving us the air that we breathe and taking in the carbon dioxide that which we exhale. And so at that point, without the green and growing nations, we would die. They are our relations. And so at that point, you must respect the trees. You must respect the shrubs. The same is true of the four-leggeds, those things which creep and crawl, those things that swim. The winged nations, the cloud nations, the star nations, and all else which has been placed into our universe are our relations, because each and every one participates in a rhythm of life that sustains us.
And you say that this expression, all my relations in Lakota, is used at the conclusion of a prayer.
Yes, ma'am.
This would be a time you would say
this. It's a wonderful way to end a prayer because at that point, the prayer is never really ended. It's merely passed on to the next one who is going to pray.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Paradise author Garth Nielsen. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Garth Nielsen, who wrote two books to honor his Native American friends. Well, you also, in your book, talk about the winter count and how our concept of time is different from other cultures, that
yes.
we have a linear concept of
yes,
time.
Yes.
So what is the winter count?
Okay. Primarily, the people of the Great Plains, the Lakota, the Arapaho, Cheyenne, Kiowa, those people, and many others, they would take a skin, preferably a buffalo hide, a tanned buffalo hide, and they would record certain incidences that really affected that particular band or that particular tribe. And like I mentioned in there, for instance, when gold was discovered at Sutter's Fort, that wasn't anything that would be recorded. But when the streams of wagons and foot travel and the coming of the steamboats up the Missouri River and the coming of the Bluecoats or the Army, those are the things that would be recorded in a winter count. When the smallpox epidemics hit and hundreds of people were devastated and died, those are the things that would have been recorded on a winter count. I mentioned in there a situation that was told to me about a chief of one of the Lakota, the branches of the Lakota Nation, who, because of the devastation that was taking place in Indian country in the late 1800s, during one of their sun dances, a chief gave 50 pieces of flesh from each arm as a prayer for the people, for the children, so that they would survive. This was recorded on a winter count as something that was extraordinary.
My guest is Garth Nielsen. He lives in Paradise now, but he's traveled all over making an odyssey, as he calls it, the odyssey of a spiritual nomad, and studying Native American culture. And you mentioned they would record it, say, on a buffalo hide. And
yeah.
we know that they used the skins of the buffalo. But you talk in your book about this reverence, all my relations, this reverence for life in whatever form. And you have a paragraph concerning buffalo, because they suspected one time, well, these Indians just wasted these buffalo. They're lying these bones here. But you say, no, that historical documentation indicate that when traditional people kill an animal, every single part of the animal is used. Nothing is wasted. A Dakota friend told me that when a buffalo is slaughtered and processed, there's not even enough for the ants to carry away.
That's right.
Never is an animal killed for trophy. Never is an animal killed for just the heart or the tongue or the hide. Native tradition and spirituality state that all animals are their relations.
That's right.
This goes back to that expression in Lakota. They do not view the killing of an animal as another type of harvesting of crops. Life is sacred and taken only after prayers have been said.
That's right. That's right.
And I think this, too, is something that comes across in your book that those of us of European descent need to pay attention to.
Thank you for saying so.
You also say, a person's spiritual strength is fortified by repeated participation in sacred ceremonies. And you've had the privilege of participating in some
many
of those.
Many times.
So why do you find them valuable?
Well, first of all, I don't throw verbal stones at anybody's beliefs. A person follows a spiritual path that has been laid before them, and that's the path that they should follow until such time as they are given clues as to maybe take a look at what they're doing or where they're going, at which time that has to be considered.
Well, you talk about other things that as part of, you might say, ritual or ceremony. For example, before you enter a wilderness or a desert, you ask permission of the spirits of that place.
Oh, yes.
And there are three things that you carry with you when you go into the desert. And I think people would find this interesting because cigarettes have been vilified, so we don't view tobacco as a positive. But that's one of the things you say you take into the desert, tobacco, sage, and cedar.
Yes, ma'am.
And you say that tobacco is the Creator's gift to access the sacred world.
That's exactly right. Now, first of all, cigarette tobacco has been so modified with chemicals that it's not even tobacco basically any longer, but pure, unadulterated, the unadulterated leaves of the tobacco plant are indeed a gift from the Creator so that we can access the spirituality that we need. And so when you go into the desert, especially down in southern Arizona, where I lived for 25 years in Tucson area, there are a lot of things out there that's going to get you if you're not careful. And I mean that most sincerely.
A rattlesnake comes to mind.
Desert diamondbacks can get longer than this room we're sitting in. But in any event, whether there were venomous snakes or not, I mean, there are spirits of the land and in the land. And it's when people recognize the fact that there are indeed beneficent as well as malevolent, but beneficent spirits which need to be addressed and recognized and recognize it to a point where you put down a pinch of tobacco and say, thank you, or may I enter this area with your permission.
Well, you also say that when you go on a vision quest, and yes. I think people have probably heard of a vision quest, but you put together a medicine bag.
Yes, ma'am.
And so I would guess tobacco is in your medicine bag?
It can be. It depends.
But that's more of the offering that you're taking.
Yeah.
The medicine bag
is your personal vision, yeah. what you have been shown to take with you.
And you mentioned that in these things that you're presenting don't have to exclude people who are raised in a Christian background.
That's
because,
right.
For example, Jesus went on vision quest.
That's right.
It wasn't labeled that in the Bible. It's just saying he spent 40 days in the wilderness.
That comes out to the same thing, really.
So you say that in your own view that you are blending these paths.
I was raised in a Christian tradition. And as I've gotten older, in my younger days, but as I got older from when I was a child, I began to take a hard look at what, because I was in the Reno School District where I grew up, we had Paiute, Shoshone, and Washoe kids.
And these cultures were labeled as pagan and
That's
heathen,
right.
And they were the other.
That's right. And so I began to take a hard look at that. Why are these people being pushed aside? Why are they being stigmatized? So I began to read. In my early teen years, I began to read, and I tried to make some comparisons. These are people the same as I am. Their blood is as red as mine. They hurt when I hurt. They feel pain when I feel pain. They feel joy when I feel joy. What makes them so, just because their skins are darker color, what's the problem here? And so I began to read more and delve more, and I began to meet with Paiute elders who have now since, again, into the spirit world, and who were very hesitant at first but shared some of their knowledge with me. And I began to say to myself that the comparisons between the way I was raised and what these people are telling me that are their traditions, they're not really that different at all. And I have come to the conclusion that if the early Jesuits, when they were coming across, when France was a primary participant in the colonization of North America, if the Jesuits had been willing to sit down and take a look and talk, there might not have been the bloodshed. There might not have been the misunderstanding. There might not have been the cruelty and the hurt that history records.
My guest is Garth Nielsen, and he's written a collection of essays, The Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad. And you've just been talking about there are parallels between Christian scripture and traditional native beliefs.
That's right.
So you don't have to choose one or the other, and your path is one of blending these two. And then I was interested in how your artistic spirit, your artistic heart, infuses the way you approach these native beliefs, because what you say is in your paintings and writings, logic is not that important. Logic can hide magic.
That's right.
And I love that it's very brief, but very, the two words, logic and magic, and that you, and art is a way that you can communicate with your creator and he with you. You say he.
Yes,
in
ma'am.
Your book.
Well, for lack of a better phrase.
Right. So when you say logic can hide magic, what should the rest of us be paying attention to?
the magic within you, the magic that's all around you, the magic that is around you that most people don't even bother to take the time to discover, because the world is magic. I mean, look at that little dog running down the street. Look at that beautiful tree. Look at the birds flying in the sky. Look at the rainbow after a rain. Well, we need the rain, yeah, but I mean, when it does rain, look at the rainbow. Look at the beautiful snowstorm in the mountains up at Shasta or Lassen. That's magic. There's magic all around us if we would just merely take the time to look with the eyes and the ears of our hearts rather than the eyes and the ears of our head. Because it's those hidden eyes and hidden ears are the ones that open the universe and the Creator to us.
My guest, Garth Nielsen, and we were talking about his book, The Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad, and I think you don't have to tell people then that you believe in spirits, because I think that comes across that you do.
Yes, ma'am. That's been manifested to my wife and I many times.
And so you encourage the rest of us to be open to the spirit world.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I most surely do, because it's my firm belief that has been taught to me by the people that I've been associated with over the years, that at the beginning of time when the Creator made everything, He put spirits in the four directions with a purpose, a distinct purpose to do certain things. And if we would pay attention to what those certain things might be, it's a major help in our walk.
And one view that we, I think, as Anglos, have a short-term view of maybe just our generation, maybe the next generation. And there's an expression that is in coming into our own parlance, and that is the seventh generation.
That's
yet to come. And as I was reading your book, I looked over, and a couple of feet away was a box of tissues, and written on that was seventh generation.
That's right. That's right.
So I think there is hope for us, Garth. Do you think so?
I most surely do, because to talk, there was what they call a faith keeper in the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois, and a man at the Onondaga Reservation. His name is Orrin Lyons. And one of the things that he taught to me was, as long as there are four people left, life will continue. One to sing, one to dance, one to pray, and one to continue. Life will go on.
And so we need to keep in mind not just what we're doing at this moment for ourselves, but that seventh generation that's going to be coming along.
Behind you, there were seven generations. You are the seventh generation of six people, six generations behind you. And they were looking out for you. And they were making sure that what they had that was good would be passed on to you. That's our obligation. That's our responsibility.
In fact, you say that in the preface of your book. You say, you have the phrase giveaway.
Yeah.
That these gifts that you have been given.
Yes.
At this point in your life, at age 75.
Yes, ma'am.
It's time for you to give away.
That's right.
These gifts.
That's right. And I hope that my book is viewed in those terms.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
It has been my pleasure.
And pilgrims wish each other buen camino.
I'm sorry?
Pilgrims on the route to Santiago,
yes,
wish each other buen camino, meaning not just this path that you're walking right now, but your path in life. So would you wish our listeners one more time, all my relations?
Metakoye oyasan, all my relations.
My guest today has loved the high deserts all his life and has embraced Native American traditions. When he was an adult, Garth Nielsen was adopted by a woman of the Turtle Clan of the Iroquois. He's been able to talk to many elders over the years and participate in traditional ceremonies. In appreciation to all those who have reached out to him in friendship over the years, Garth Nielsen compiled stories from his own experiences and from tales told to him by the people he met. His first book, Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad, he described his personal journey of discovery. He now has published a second collection of stories called Petroglyphs. Garth Nielsen, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, when I first saw your cover, the name of your book is Petroglyphs, and I saw the petroglyphs on the cover, and I wasn't sure if somebody had, this was a sketch or a photograph, and then I realized, well, it's a photograph of a sketch, so to speak. Describe the cover of your book for us.
The petroglyphs on the cover of this book are from a Nevada State Park outside of Las Vegas. It's called the Valley of Fire, and this particular area is literally covered with petroglyphs that go back centuries.
So if people would like to see some real petroglyphs, there really is not that far a drive to see them.
No, it's not.
But you didn't. You weren't the one who took this photograph.
No, my friend Kim Victoria, who is the wife of Tom Watson, she is, like myself, is totally enamored of the Southwest. And she has spent a lot of time down in southern Nevada and northeastern Arizona. And she's the one that took these. And she's got an incredible collection of photographs that she's taken from the Valley of Fire.
So she probably didn't have to make a separate trip. She may have already had this in her photographic file.
She and I went through all of her photographs to pick out what we wanted to put on the cover.
Well, you mentioned that she is married to Tom Watson, and you, in your dedication, acknowledge both Kim and her husband, Tom Watson.
Yes.
And how did Tom help?
I owe Tom my literary life, literally. I was, through an acquaintance, I was asked to join a small writing club up in Paradise. And Tom is a member of that club as well. And after about 3 or 4 weeks of, you know, the participants reading the things that they had written, one day Tom said to me, "I'd like to speak to you privately." And we went outdoors and he said, "Look, I really like what you've written. I'd like to get to know you better and I want to sit and talk with you." And so, to use the cliche, the rest is history. We have discussed in great measure a lot of what I've done, and he said, "You need to be out there. People need to read what you've written." And this is the result of my acquaintance with Tom Watson.
Well, you might mention that Tom is not just an unpublished writer giving you advice, but he has actually published quite a number of books himself.
Yes.
What is his specialty?
Children's literature, and he's very, very good, and he's very well received, by the way.
Yes, I know Tom.
Oh.
And I also, when I saw in the local paper, the Enterprise Record recently, that Tom is now president of a new writers club here, and you are also a part of this club.
As of last month, I am a brand new member. I've only been one time.
Well, this is actually new because, as I understand it, the California Writers Club has created this branch called the North State Writers Branch that Tom Watson is the president. And then a couple of other local writers are also a part of this. And I didn't know that the California Writers Club is the second oldest writers organization in the country.
That's right.
I would have thought someplace back east would have been had that honor.
This was started by Jack London. A lot of people don't know that, but that's an interesting thing in itself.
Yes, it is. So you have become a member of a group whose origins go back to Jack London.
Yes.
We might mention that this group meets Mondays, the third Monday of the month, from 6 to 8 p.m. if there are people out there who are aspiring writers.
I would suggest that anybody who feels that they want to try to get whatever they've written out there, this is the place to maybe come and see what you can do.
And appropriately, it meets at the Chico Library.
That's right.
My guest is Garth Nielsen, and his new book is called Petroglyphs. And it is a collection of short stories, thoughts, observations, and impressions about traditional Native Americans that he has known and the landscapes they inhabit. Now, I mentioned the cover of your book, the front cover. The back cover is a photograph of you, and you're not the only one in the picture.
That horse belongs to a good friend of mine who is a world champion barrel racer. That horse cost $20,000.
Oh, my goodness. So are you a horse rider yourself?
I was once, but I can't because of my bad leg and back. I can't ride anymore.
But you look very distinguished with your walking cane, Garth.
Thank you.
Well, complete the picture for us as to how you dress normally.
That's how I dress normally.
Which is you wear... Well,
very casually. The turquoise necklace was a gift many, many years ago from a dear friend. I do smoke a pipe.
Yes, because in the picture you have a pipe.
Yeah, and what else?
And your hat.
The little button on the hat up there was a nickel that was carved out with just the Indian left on it, and it was gilded. And an acquaintance gave that to me, so I wear that on my hat.
So your necklace has meaning for you, your turquoise necklace that you were wearing in the photograph, and right now.
Yes.
And your hat that is also special. And it looks like cowboy boots.
I was born in boots.
Well, actually, where were you born? Because it sounds like you were born out in the high desert, but you weren't.
No, I was born in Glendale, California, but at the age of six, my parents moved to Reno, and back in those days, Reno was a little cow town, basically, and I lived my whole life up in northern Nevada, Reno, Carson City, that whole area.
Well, there's a little section in your book where you mention you're telling this in the first person, and this is on page 10, Garth, and this section of your book is one that's called The Skull. And the reason I'd like you to read that is because you mentioned your father in this section. Would you read that for us, please?
Yes, ma'am. My father was born and bred in a large eastern city. For years, all his thoughts were shaped by decisions from a crowded and consensual accordance until he moved to Nevada as a young adult. A change, subtle but unyielding, in its grasp began to occur within him and call into question all of these old thought patterns. He fell under the influence of the spirits of limitless horizons of sagebrush and pinion-dotted hills, mirages that shimmered across the salt pan playas, and vistas where the vestiges of the early settlers and those who had passed through, bound for the glories of California, could still be found. When the turquoise gem of Pyramid Lake first met his astonished gaze, the die was cast. Every opportunity that presented itself was a reason for making the 32-mile drive from Reno, summer or winter. During the summer, nearly every weekend was spent under a lean-to of furniture blankets, while my brother and I swam or skimmed stones as flat as silver dollars across the placid surface of the lake. My father even bought a boat that he sailed across the lake so that he could look more closely at the namesake pyramid. We never went ashore on Anaho Island, a federally protected bird refuge. One incident that stands out vividly in my memory is the day my father found the upper half of a human skull on the beach at Pyramid Lake. The gentle waves washed around it, making the long green moss clinging around it appear as undulating hair. I remember thinking that it could have been the remains of a mermaid. Was it from a drowned swimmer or someone sucked down by quicksand patches found in the northwest end of the lake? We were told that the lake had been used as a bombing range during World War II. Perhaps it was the remains of a lost airman. Or was the skull much older? We never knew. I won't say that this beautiful, mysterious lake took what rightfully belonged there. Rather, I would say that some long-forgotten soul returned to our Creator and became part of the mystique, one with the spirit of place. One has to wonder about such a death. I long ago abandoned the concept that accidents happen. Things happen for a reason. But still, what was the reason for this death? Was this a man or a woman? I believe all life returns to our Creator. So all that we see is the residual of life on earth.
My guest is Garth Nielsen, and he's reading from his new book, Petroglyphs. A couple of things strike me in what you were just saying, Garth, that I think the rest of us might benefit from paying attention to. One, you say that for years, you're talking about your father now, for years all his thoughts were shaped by decisions from a crowded and consensual accordance until he moved to Nevada as a young adult. That consensual accordance...
My father was born in New York City. At the age of six, my grandmother returned her family to Denmark, which is where she was born. And when they came back to the United States about 4 years later, he couldn't even speak English then. He had to learn English all over again. And everything was shaped by the metropolis of New York City. And he was very locked into a cityfied way of looking at life. And when he moved to Nevada, it was almost like a screen was pulled down before his eyes. And everything that had been in his past suddenly vanished, and he became literally a new person. The persona of the desert did its job, and it did it well. My father became a bona fide desert rat.
So what he thought was who he was when he was living in the city,
yes,
that's who he thought he was.
That's right.
And then when he came to Nevada, he thought, no, this is who I am.
Exactly. You've got it. That is exactly it.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. We're going to take a break and then more stories from Garth Nielsen's book, Petroglyphs. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is author of two books, Odyssey of a Spiritual Nomad and Petroglyphs. Well, then a little bit later on in this section, you say, I long ago abandoned the concept that accidents happen. Things happen for a reason.
I truly believe that. Well, I'll be 77 next month. So in 77 years of living this life that has been given to me, I have, as most people would begin, things happen. Well, that's just an accident. But as the years roll by and you begin to take a look at things that have happened in the past, how your life is progressing in the present, and how you hope to see it progress in the future, you begin to realize everything is a chain of events, and that what happened 10 years ago impacts directly on what you're doing, what you're saying, what you're thinking right now. And this is why it happened, so that you could think and do and say what you're doing right now. And there is no such thing as an accident. In northern New Mexico, where a lot of the small villages back up in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, the people speak a Spanish that's not readily understood by people in Arizona or California who speak Spanish. That they speak an archaic Spanish. And they have a word, chiripada. And chiripada basically means serendipitous. And I think that's such a great word. It's not used anymore, but it's a great word.
In fact, I might mention that you do have words in here from Native American language and from Spanish in a glossary,
yes,
in the back. So if people are reading along and they wonder, for example, what a buaro arro is, for example, that was a buzzard, which you tell, yeah, us you can look back. Because in, yeah, the story itself, you don't say what that is, but people can refer to the glossary and say,
right,
oh, that's a buzzard.
Right.
The story that you were just telling, and then you say that things don't happen by accident. They happen for a reason.
They happen for a definite reason.
And it seems, too, that you are open to guidance. From what source do you think your guidance comes, Garth?
My guidance, I truly believe, comes from one source, but it's spread out, if you will. Ultimately, it comes from God Almighty, if you will. But who works through the spirits of the land and the spirits of those who have gone before, who impact on my thinking. You can't walk in a place like the Valley of Fire, where the panels of petroglyphs that are thousands of years old, without knowing, not just thinking it might be the case, but actually knowing that the person who did that is still there.
Well, you also, at one point in the story you're telling, say it felt good to be here. And I think a lot of people have had that experience, Garth, of being in a place where they just feel so at home and so comfortable. And that sounds like what the desert is for you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It truly is.
If we were to put you back in New York City where your father was, for example.
I would die within a week. I got to believe. I truly do. I think I'd die within a week.
Well, just before this story that you just read, which you're speaking in the first person, that really, you say, happened, and I can just imagine coming across, you know, you're out with your dad, and you see half a human skull on the beach, that you wonder, my goodness, how could this, what is the story behind this skull?
I've wondered that my whole life, exactly. That's what I've tried to describe in the small piece that I wrote there.
Mm-hmm. Well, just before this, you have this just a little paragraph, the voices of the people. And you say, when I hear the speech of the people, I understand not one word, but the passion in their hearts speaks to mine. The passion in their hearts speaks to mine. It is the music of their speech, not one word of which I understand, that sings in my heart.
That's right. That piece right there basically came from a number of years of attending the Sundance down in southern Arizona at a place called Big Mountain. And it was primarily on what in those days was known as the joint use area, but the Navajo people have such a musical speech, and it's so melodic. And to hear an elder will say, an elder woman, 70, 80, 90 years old, they don't stutter, they don't hesitate, but it's a flowing, like a stream. Their language flows like a stream, and it puts goosebumps on your arm.
Well, I sometimes, when I hear a poem in a language that I may not even understand, but the poetry, like you say, the musicality of it, yeah. I understand it, it touches me.
Absolutely, yes, yes. And this is what makes people want to get to know these people.
Well, speaking of getting to know them, you tell us as readers what the Native American experience is like, if I may sum it up that
sure.
way, in the very first story in your book. And some of these things you are telling in the first person because they were your experiences.
Yes, ma'am.
But this story, the first story in your book, is entitled Amos Chalk. Who was or is Amos Chalk?
Amos Chalk is a metaphor. He is a metaphor for those Native people who are attempting to maintain as strongly as possible the traditions, the way of life, the language that has been handed down to them through the centuries, and that they're, in many cases, they're being forced to assimilate against their will into the dominant society, which is what I'm trying to explain there. And that when the airplane crashes, I'm trying to show that this technology really has no place in the life of a person who is following the traditional road of their people.
Well, let's tell the listeners what happens to Amos Chalk.
Okay.
Amos Chalk is in an airplane, and you mentioned there's a doctor in the plane, and then you say the man from the bureau, and you don't say what bureau. It's not the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It's not the Federal Bureau of Land Management. It is, and we have to assume, Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Assume correctly.
So go ahead and tell what happens in the story so we'll understand what you're...
Amos Chalk is being raised by his sister and her husband, and they want him to go to the Indian school at Stewart, which, by the way, no longer exists as an Indian school. It was closed down many years ago, and he doesn't want to go. And so they make make arrangements, and he goes with the doctor and the Bureau of Indian Affairs man, and they fly to Carson City. He goes to Stewart. He sees it. He doesn't want to be there, and they're flying home, and the airplane crashes in the mountains. And the doctor and the man from the Bureau are killed, and Amos is left to his own devices. And I'm trying to say here that he sees that there, this airplane took him out. And I'm trying to show the analogy that modern technology has no place for people with who are basically following the traditional way of life. And so he takes off to try to find out where he's at and hopefully get home. And things happen to him as he's walking across the desert. He sees mirages. And he sees the skeleton of a coyote in the playa and that he's walking across. And as he's walking, the spirits of the land and the spirits of his ancestors are all about him. And they are there to support him. And as he's thinking, as he's walking, of an elder who is sitting on the bench of the store at the little town of Owyhee up on the Duck Valley Reservation, Mrs. Charlie. And Mrs. Charlie represents everything that's good and pure and wonderful about the traditional way of life of the people. And he wants to reach out to her. And he says he wants to help her, but in reality, he's asking her for her help to him.
My guest has been Garth Nielsen, and his new book is Petroglyphs. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.